I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. In my childhood years, our family had several TV rituals that came around once a year. This was in the days before on-demand content, so you got to see a special once a year or you missed it. And watching the 1966 movie Born Free was one of those rituals. I still remember even the theme song. I don't remember the plot that well, but essentially it's a sentimental celebration of treating wildlife ethically. There are these Europeans. They're in Kenya. They rescue a lion cub. They name her Elsa. They treat her very kindly, benevolently, and eventually they reintroduce her to the wild. They set her free. Now, I'm telling you this because my entire life, for as long as I can remember, going back to Born Free, I've been working off this template, this worldview of nature being out there, humans being right back here where we belong. And there's this difference that's not only important but geographical. It's physical in this worldview. Maybe it was once that way, the border between us and them, humans and wild things, but the truth is very different these days. That boundary is far less physical than it is behavioral. And the tensions between human civilization and nature red in tooth and claw is fraught. It's constant and frequently violent. Mary Roach has some great stories to tell about this overlap between humans and animals in her latest book. It's titled Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. She is the author of New York Times bestsellers Stiff, Spook, Bonk, Gulp, Grunt. Those are all individual titles. And finally, Packing for Mars. She's written for National Geographic, for Wired, the New York Times Magazine, just to name a few. It's a pleasure to have her joining with us now. Mary Roach, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you so much, Marcus. You know I can sing that theme song.
I hope you can. That's right.
Born free. I won't torture you.
As free as the wind blows. You know, the subtitle of your book, Mary, makes me laugh, When Nature Breaks the Law, because it seems to pin a kind of criminality on creatures that are really just living the law of the jungle.
That's right. They're just animals being animals. They are doing the things that animals do. They are going after food. They are looking for a place to have their young and raise their young. They're taking a crap. And every now and then they're doing that around humans, on humans' property, in humans' attics, on humans' roads. They don't know that they're breaking our laws, but they do it, and people get annoyed, and then we have what is called, in the scientific vernacular, human-wildlife conflict.
That's really technical. I'm gonna
human-wildlife conflict.
Well, you know, there's enough violence in what you describe in some of this that you could have titled the book Teeth.
Teeth and Claw.
but why Fuzz?
Sounds like a pub.
How did you settle on Fuzz?
Well, the original title was Animal Vegetable Criminal, which was quite to the point. Yeah, but Mark Bittman, the food writer for the New York Times, published a book in February called Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food.
Yeah.
My publisher felt like it would seem as though I copied him or there'd be so much confusion. Anyway, Fuzz was my original on the book proposal. Fuzz as in the slang for police and fuzz as in fuzzy animal.
Yeah, I thought that was the double meaning there. Yeah.
Well,
you spent some time shadowing some people, I guess, in British Columbia, and it's the wildlife-human attack response training something team. I don't know.
Yes.
how long were you shadowing that and what did you see up there?
Well, it's actually the WART, the Wildlife Human Attack Response Training it's a week long training in the forensics of wildlife attack crime scene. Not crime as in an animal has killed a person, not literally a crime. The people who are teaching it were from British Columbia. Weirdly, it was actually being held in a casino outside Reno. They move it around every year, and it, for some reason, was there in a place where no wildlife was present, except the Betty the Yeti slot machine, I guess, if you can count that. But anyway, so it was part classroom training, and it was also hands-on training. We had a bunch of we were split into groups, and each group had a soft touch mannequin that had been doctored up to look like the victim of a mauling, whether it was a mountain lion or a bear. They were quite realistic, pretty gory. And right next to us was a large bingo game going on in the next room. So it was kind of an odd people from the bingo game must have wondered sometimes.
Yeah. You know, in spite of the venue for all of this, did you get into it? Were you just really right there trying to absorb and learn?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. It was fascinating because we started out, in these groups, just learning how to tell the difference between, by looking at the body, the claw marks and the teeth marks and the characteristic patterns of attack, whether it was a bear or a mountain lion or a human, because sometimes animals have been blamed for murders that in fact a human committed, and vice versa. Sometimes it was an animal, but a person was blamed. So though that was fascinating. And then getting down into the nitty gritty of how do you find the right, if say it's a bear, how do you find the right bear? And if you forgot the wrong bear, you let that bear go. So there are these interesting overlaps with the human criminal justice system. So we were doing that. And then we were out in a simulated attack scene out. There's a little road that goes down near the Truckee River. And there's bunch of scenes in the shrubs and the bushes, you know, there'll be like bits of evidence planted, you know, scuffle marks, animal tracks, blood drips, a body. And we had to pretend there was these simulations, you know, we would have a group of people going in to investigate. There were role players coming up pretending to be, say, the sister of the victim. And we were gathering evidence, you know, doing the things they do on those police procedurals, but planting the little evidence flag, collecting the evidence, taking measurements, all of that. It was really cool.
How great a need is there really for this kind of training? I mean, I have always thought of this kind of forensic activity as being so specialized and rarely, carried out. But if there's a wart training group from British Columbia going around giving training sessions here, is this with law enforcement agencies? And who are the attendees? And is it everywhere?
The people attending, a lot of them were from Canada because there's a lot of bears in British Columbia and in the western parts of Canada. Also people from the western United States and some from the north. So places where there are populations of bears, both grizzly and black bears, and mountain lions. For the most part, I mean, wolves also, though it's so, so rare for a wolf to kill a human. So they were coming in from all over. They you know, wart itself is held once a year. I think there were 80 people attending, and they work for wildlife agencies, fish and game agencies, or fish and wildlife. Up in Canada, they're called the Conservation Corps officers. They're the people who come in when there is an attack, so they do need to know these things so that, because they're kind of on call for this. And you can become certified as a predator attack specialist. I have my certificate.
What are you going to do with that certificate now?
Yeah, nothing. It's just a certificate of attendance. I didn't actually stick around and take the test.
Well, you know, fresh in my mind this year is the fact that our family went to Yellowstone and the Tetons and have been here in the Utah mountains. And I have a young boy who was adamant that we have our bear spray with us. So I'm a little bit, it's on my mind. And to visit with somebody like you, I don't want you to gross us out, but when it comes to those bear teeth and cougar teeth and the claws of each, you learned some kind of gruesome stuff about their MO when they're taking on a human.
Well, yeah, they're very different approaches. I'm talking bears versus mountain lions. And I should say, in both cases, it's so, so very rare that someone is killed in an attack. And very often, it's not an attack, but a defense. There in the United States, between 0 and 3 people per year are killed by bears, and far fewer by mountain lions. I mean, a decade will go by without a mountain lion killing in California. So it's very, very, I mean, compare that to a dozen or more people per year killed in dog attacks or snake bites. killed by snake bites. So it's very, very rare. And it is typically a crime of opportunity. In other words, it's the bear is typically trying to get something that you've got, food in particular. And sometimes bears get quite bold and they'll come in bear country. They'll come into a cabin or a home when the person isn't there. Sometimes when the person is there, typically if they're startled by the person there, they will back off and run away. I mean, they're not. But what happens sometimes is if someone's got a dog and the dog gets involved with the bear and the person tries to intervene, then there's something called attack redirection and the bear may assault the person. But sometimes bears also, you know, they feel threatened. They may do a bluff charge, sort of come at the person, and typically, in that case, you just sort of back off and speak calmly and try to show that you're not, in fact, a threat. But yeah, if in those very, very rare instances where a bear actually does decide to take on a human, they do what bears do when they fight each other, which is they go for the face, because a bear's face is lightly furred, so they kind of go teeth to teeth. And so, unfortunately, that means you see some pretty gruesome injuries to the head and neck area with bear attacks.
Yeah, the closest I've been to any of this is understanding the way raccoons will go at chickens and rip their heads off, you know, and leave the rest of the body untouched. And I thought of that immediately because humans are wearing clothing, and you have a little bit to say about what you've learned that I guess they can identify a face exposed as it is, not covered with clothing, as being something to attack.
Well, they go for the bears will go for the face just because that's what they do with each other. But in general, I was surprised to see that in the victims, that the mock victims that they'd created at this conference, you didn't see people gutted, the torso opened and the animal going for the organs. I thought that was unusual because I know that predators, when they go after their natural prey, you know, like big cats, they'll often eat the organs because they're the most nutritious. They've got vitamin A, vitamin C, minerals. I mean, if you want a healthy diet as a meat eater, organ meats are the best thing, actually. So they may, they gross humans out a bit, but they are actually very nutritious, and the predators will go for that. And I said to the guy leading our group, why are there no injuries like that? And he said, well, people are wearing clothing, and for whatever reason, these animals, they don't like, either they don't like the mouthfeel of clothing, or that doesn't, it disguises the smell, but they go for exposed flesh. So wear long underwear, I guess, is the takeaway here.
Yeah. You know, with this description, I am all ready to move on to the threat of trees, because I don't think trees are going to go for my internal organs, are they?
Not so much.
You do talk about trees, and I've been up in the Redwoods in recent years, and to see giant trees that have fallen, you know, it's a quiet place to be out in the forest until a tree falls.
Until a tree falls. You really don't want to be in the way. One of those big guys comes down, which it does from time to time. There's a couple of job titles I quite liked for this chapter that has to do with trees. Danger trees, that is a category of tree, a tree that is posing a danger in that part of it is diseased or rotting, or it's just very, very old and just starting to become unstable and going to come down in the near future. So there are people who go around, particularly you mentioned the redwoods, in groves of legacy trees, you know, big, giant, ancient, hundreds of years old trees that people love to walk amid and kind of respect and gaze at. And those trees that people love and want to see and be around are very, very old. And a very, very old tree is often a danger tree because it's in its twilight years and it is going to fall relatively soon. I say relatively soon. I mean, trees die over a span of like 100 years. If you're living 500 years, it may take you 100 years to die. But when it happens and if you're in the way, then that's bad. So there are people called danger tree assessors who go around and they look for the telltale signs of decrepitude and rot, fungal rot. And they make a decision at a certain point, something has to be done to avoid a death and likely a lawsuit.
Well, here's a crazy question for you, because I know you've already addressed the idea, or you've mentioned the idea, that sometimes it's difficult to tease out whether a human killed by, say, a cougar or a bear may not have been killed by that cougar or bear. And you have to figure out, is that a human crime that's been mm-hmm. committed? Is there a murder? But you can't. Is the same thing happening with redwoods? Are people wondering if the criminal was the tree or a human?
Oh, I don't think that's ever happened, because typically the tree
stays on the crime scene.
On top of the the tree isn't going to flee the crime scene.
Right.
That's right. Even cases like there's a couple cases of a durian. You know what a durian fruit is?
Sure.
It's a big, heavy fruit with kind of a spiky, hard exterior. And there's been cases, there were two or three, I think it was either two or three cases of a person being killed by a fallen durian fruit. And the one photograph that's like the bloody durian fruit is, you know, the murder weapon, as it were, is it's right there, because the tree's, you know, the tree's not going to throw it in the river.
Well, you see, I'm very glad I asked the question. Because, well,
yeah, pretty clear when it's the tree doing the killing.
I want to jump to a story about seagulls that you bring up. And one of the reasons I bring this up is because, you know, where I live in my own religious tradition, there's the equivalent of the Vatican. We call it Temple Square. And we have a seagull monument. It's a revered – it's the state bird, the seagulls.
Yeah.
But you've got a Vatican story where the seagulls were not so welcome.
I love it. And you know what? That state bird of Utah, it's a California gull.
It is.
Yeah. That's one of my favorites.
We ditched out on the Colorado spruce being our state tree, and we've now recently, at the urging of school children, adopted the quaking aspen. So Colorado, a spruce, California. We're stuck with the California gull still, but take us to the Vatican.
Okay, the Vatican had a problem with gulls, and it was a kind of a mystery problem, because gulls aren't really known to attack flowers. But here's what happened. It was Easter Sunday, Easter Mass. The Pope says Mass out on the balcony over St. Peter's Square. Up to 80,000 people in attendance. Huge floral display. Massive trucks, refrigerated trucks, drive down from the Netherlands. Three of them, I think. And it takes all day to set up this flower display, 6,000 daffodils, thousands of cut roses. And the night before, in the wee hours, these gulls came in and wreaked havoc. There were pots overturned, roses strewn about. It was kind of a mess. A couple hours before the public was supposed to come in, they were running around setting things up, and it was kind of a fiasco. So the following year, the guy from the Netherlands went on television and said, what would you recommend? What should I do? And the person who called him up and won the opportunity to be the gull deterring entity was a man who's designed a laser scarecrow. So it's basically just looks like a few boxes stacked on top of each other with a number of lasers that rotate around, and this beam shoots out, and kind of like a laser light show. And so this is something that's playing all night, the night before Easter Mass, which if you didn't know that, when you walked through St. Peter's Square at 4 a.m, you'd be like, what? Are those fireflies? Is this weird, just, you know, the light, it's sort of green and it's zipping around and hitting all the plants. So I was there for the duration of the pre-Easter protection of the plants.
Yeah, you know, in the story you've just told, I'm just putting it together. I did not know that seagulls were active in the nighttime hours like this.
Yeah, they're not typically, but seagulls, and the night that I went, I went out around 5 a.m. There were a bunch of them sleeping on the cobblestones, which are nice and warm, just kind of like hanging out. So it's not typical. Some gulls are beginning to take nocturnal shifts to raid the garbage in Rome. That's something else going on. When you have a large population of, whether it's a bird or a rodent or whatever, when the numbers get high enough that they're competing for food, some of them may switch and like take the night shift. So that may be what's happening. People have theorized that. But it's weird, because they weren't eating these plants. They were just going in, and it was as though they had some vendetta against the Pope. It's just we're going to mess with you. You spent all day yesterday setting up these plans. Wow, watch this. Watch what a mess we can make in 10 minutes.
Well, what do you think about the idea that we're talking about people who revere St. Francis of Assisi and his friendship with birds, you know, and here they're chasing them off the Vatican Plaza?
Well, but they were chasing them gently, just with some green light. They were not nothing mean was done to them. But the thing that was kind of funny to me is that it's a small enough space that you could have just hired one of those, you know, the Swiss Guard guys with the striped knickers and the funny hats. You could have just had somebody out there all night just shooing off the gulls. But instead we had the laser scarecrow.
Yeah, it's a high-tech world.
Exactly. It's a high-tech world.
Well, we're going to take a short break and then come back and chat some more with Mary Roach about her new book titled Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. Our next criminals, we might talk a little bit about elephants, crows. Great stories there as well. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. Mary Roach, well known for her books Stiff, Spook, Gulp, Grunt, and other such monosyllable titles, is with us now for Fuzz, her latest book, Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. Who is Captain Raj in India, and what is his function?
Oh, Captain Raj is...
Or Officer Raj, maybe.
Officer Raj, yes. He's on the elephant beat. He is someone who is called in when elephants are threatening to trample and run rampant in the agricultural spaces of a community. This is northern India. This is something that's happening more and more with the land. I mean, elephants are big. They need a lot of food. They need a lot of land. Both of those are shrinking with the encroachment of mankind. So people and elephants are coming into conflict more often. And the best thing you can do is prevent this by, you know, leaving land for them and, you know, protecting land and trying to keep the two species apart. But given that we are having a lot of these conflicts, there are researchers who are training and putting together elephant response teams. So they sort of bring villagers in and give them best practices, as it were, for if a bunch of elephants come into your community and your gardens, here's the best thing to do. And certainly, if you can, get a professional elephant response team over there to do their thing. They usually come over in a vehicle. A lot of times the elephants recognize even the sound of that vehicle and they leave. But, you know, people, if you don't have somebody well-trained, you can quickly make the situation worse by freaking the elephants out. They're a social animal. They like to be in their family groups. And if you split them up so that they're on their own, they feel threatened. They may get aggressive, and they're huge. So it's very easy to get knocked over whacked to death or stepped on. 500 people a year are killed by elephants in India.
500.
This is that's amazing.
Yeah, this is a more serious tale than lasers at the Vatican in a big way. You know, as we talk about these overlapping experiences where humans and animals are coming together, are you interested in the theme of the coexistence where we're not necessarily trying to establish a firm line of demarcation and they're over there and we're over here, but we allow for the overlap?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing to think about. It's great when that can happen. And I encourage that in several ways in the book. I mean, there's in this country, up through the middle of the last century, we tended to have a view of animals either as a commodity or as varmints that are, you know, eating our crops, destroying our livestock. And there was a lot of killing. I mean, we basically wiped out a lot of these large mammals, not wiped out to extinction, but just severely curtailed their range. And now they're, you know, with the dawn of the animal welfare movement and environmental awareness, and people just having more appreciation for wild animals as something to be valued and protected. You know, those populations are recovering, and that's great, but they're recovering to the extent that they're all getting up in people's business. And so now people's patience is eroding a little bit. It's a little bit hard to love bears when there's one actually in your kitchen.
Yeah.
Havoc. Yeah.
Well, you know, you talk about the havoc here, and if I were a farmer in Australia and the intractable emu population were coming my way, I might just be grateful if the military came out and tried to, you know, take care of the situation. And that happened. And what's your own take on whether or not the military should have been fighting the emus in Australia? Apparently, they were not successful.
No, they were not successful. It was one of those wonderful scenarios where the emus won. They were machine gunners and a General Meredith, and they came down obviously thinking this will take us half an hour. And, you know, fast forward to 5 days later, they withdraw in defeat, supposedly with a line of emus along the road as they withdrew. So that was kind of a fun story. The best thing in the case of you know, birds going after crops. I mean, the one that I wrote about in some detail in the book was the North and South Dakota is where a lot of the sunflower seeds are grown. And it's right in the path of massive annual migration by blackbirds, grackles, crows, and cowbirds. So you've got literally millions of birds passing through when you're trying to grow bird seed. So that's obviously a conflict scenario. What has been done in the past was attempts at massive annihilation, which just isn't effective. I mean, first of all, it's not nice for the birds, but it doesn't work. You know, you kill 1 million of 15 million birds, it doesn't affect the numbers in terms of agricultural loss, in terms of the population. It's not effective, and it's cruel. So the thing, you know, there've been a lot of progress made in preventing this kind of depredation. For example, learn what you can about the birds and their habits. Like, you know, if you know that they like to roost in cattail marshes, don't plant crops anywhere near cattail marshes. Or if you can somehow change the timing so that your crop isn't coming to harvest right as the birds are passing through, or plant what's called a lure crop, which is plant something that they'll find even more delicious. Plant that close by. So there's dozens of things you can try to do to prevent the loss from happening. And that's hopefully where things are headed.
Yeah. Well, Mary, I have to ask this question, kind of wanting to tie a little bit of a bow on all of this, because we've sampled stories from your book, and this human-animal interface is endlessly fascinating and fraught. I'm just wondering about animals that didn't quite make the cut for your book. You know, authors will often explore. Was there a runner-up?
Well, initially I had thought I was going to include kind of the inverse of wildlife crime. In other words, crimes against wildlife, only because I got interested in the forensics of that world. I was up at the National Fish and Wildlife Forensics Lab, and they were doing things like, okay, we're finding these headless walrus bodies. And what we need to understand, were the heads removed before they washed up? Or maybe like, when were the heads removed? In other words, was somebody cutting them off to steal the tusks, or did they decompose in the water and the head disconnected? We have to prove that, that kind of thing. Or you know, or somebody who was an expert in the difference between real and counterfeit tiger penis, which is sold medicinally in parts of Asia. So that world of forensics, I wanted to kind of find a way to cover that as well, but it was kind of messy. So I left it out, sadly.
For another day.
For another day, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this, I think, is important consideration. And I kind of wanted to lead into that, the fact that our new world is not separated into these discrete regions where we're going to be and the animals are going to be. Where's the brightest hope that you have seen for our understanding the problem and addressing it with the greatest kindness, the greatest benevolence, and also with effectiveness?
Well, there have been in recent years a number of coexistence institutes, organizations that have been founded specifically to bring together both sides, like to bring together ranchers, people in agriculture, animal welfare people, and to bring them into the same room and have them talk to each other, because they tend to withdraw to their own corners and speak to their own kind. And if you want to come up with solutions and compromises, you have to just start listening to each other. And that's been happening. There's been a lot of effort in that area. There are also the USDA Wildlife Services, who historically have been the ones farmers and ranchers have relied on to come and deal with their problem animals. They're hiring in 10, I think, states now, non-lethal specialists. In other words, people who specialize in ways to resolve the conflict without killing the quote-unquote nuisance animal. That's leading to somewhat of a change in sort of a cultural change within wildlife services, which, you know, has a somewhat of a bad reputation among animal welfare people. I mean, they do a lot of killing, and they have in the past tended to resort to that. As one person there said, the ship is turning. It's slow to turn, but it is turning. So I take some hope from that and from the efforts in the realm of coexistence, particularly when it comes to large mammals, where there's just it is a split, like the political split in this country. It feels very red and blue. Anytime you can have people speaking to each other and trying to listen, I guess listen is the key. They're not speaking. Listening and trying to come up with solutions and compromises, that feels hopeful to me.
I'm so glad I had a chance to find out about your latest book and to talk with you about it. Mary Roach, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Marcus.
Mary Roach with us. Her latest is titled Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law.
That was Marcus Smith. I'm Tenery Taylor. If lasers don't work to fend off pesky seagulls, well, then the next move might be to bring in the birds of prey. Not to kill the seagulls, but just to make them move along out of town. That's the solution one New Jersey beach community landed on. And it seems to work. Next on Constant Wonder.
Last summer, I was on family vacation with my kids and wife. We were in Kentucky eating lunch in a city park. Our little family was mobbed by a cadre of tree squirrels. They wanted every scrap of food that we inadvertently took our eyes off of, and they were very good at getting it. And this was annoying beyond belief, but I guess squirrels need to eat too. It just shouldn't be my lunch. And then when I came home from Kentucky back to Utah, we had another picnic in the park one day, and the same crime happened, but with an entirely new cast of characters, the criminals, seagulls, here in Utah. I was stunned by the bald-faced impudence of these creatures, but I have recently learned that I really have nothing to complain about compared to the Hitchcockian situation of some leisure seekers in Ocean City, New Jersey. Ocean City has turned to drastic measures in order to restore a little bit of order and rout these marauding seagulls. One of the people retained to implement these measures is Master Falconer Eric Swanson, and he's going to paint a picture for us of the problem and the possible solutions. Swanson is not only a falconer, but he's also an animal control officer and a nuisance wildlife control operator. Eric Swanson, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you for having me.
Who came to you and enlisted your services, or was it your idea that something could be done? Somebody said, let's do something. Who was that?
It was actually the mayor of Ocean City. He really got to see how bad the seagulls were getting there. And the seagulls were actually learning a new behavior where they would bite people to make them drop their boardwalk food.
Have you seen this happen?
I have. When the mayor first told me about it, I kind of said, no way. And when we got down there, I witnessed it firsthand. The seagulls on that day went right over to a woman that had I think she was eating fries. She sat down, the birds came over, one bit her, and they all mobbed in. It also seemed like they were targeting little children. I didn't see that personally, but the mayor told me a story where actually one bit a child in the face and caused it and caused the child to bleed.
Yeah, no good. And is there a solution that is just straightforward? Because what people would normally resort to is the idea of, well, I've got a BB gun.
Well, that's illegal. Gulls are protected. And it's really not such a great idea. I mean, they're not doing anything wrong. The people have caused the problem. So the people that go to the boardwalk would feed the gulls, and it's fun to feed a gull. I can remember when I was a little kid doing it with my father. You know, we throw some stuff out and watch the birds come down. But after a while, the gulls start to demand the food. In that case, they not only were they mobbing people, you know, snatching food out of their hand, but they've learned that they can actually turn a person into a French fried dispensary or pizza dispensary just by biting them and making them drop it. So the mayor did figure that he wanted something done. They didn't know what to do. They've tried just about everything and nothing had worked. And they gave us a call.
Well, how do you feel about what has been set up in New York City? I think it's appeared now in print, this line that, for these gulls to have aggression, it says the aggression stands out even in a state where pugnacity is considered a plus. That's below the belt.
It's a learned behavior, and it's caused by people. And it's not the gulls' fault. They're just trying to survive like everything else. And we're not trying to hurt them. All we do is push them off the boardwalk.
Well, let's start talking about falcons and how they enter this scene and what you have them do.
We use falcons, we use hawks, and we use an owl as well. The gulls are there at night. It's obviously lit up, so the owl gets the night shift. What we're doing is we just simply free fly falcons and hawks during the day. We use the hawks that are desert species. We use falcons that are desert species for the morning. The falcons don't like the heat as much as the hawks. And we just fly them along the boardwalk and the beach. All we're doing is every species runs from a falcon. So when the falcon goes up, the seagulls run off the area. They really don't go very far, but they learn that boardwalk becomes a very dangerous area for them to frequent. If they come in there, they have a hawk chase them. Not good for them. If they're in the morning, they have a falcon chase them. Not good for them. And at nighttime, there's an owl around. Nothing is scarier than an owl to a bird. If it's in the area, you could be subject to something coming out of the night and just snatching you.
Somewhere in that picture you just painted, you told me that a falcon is not a night owl, that you got to have the right bird at the right time of the day for the right task. All of them, though, are meant just as scare tactics, as scare gulls instead of scarecrows?
Yes, and we're intentionally flying the birds in a state of non-hunger. So this is bird abatement. If we were practicing falconry, we would be, having the bird at a lower weight where it would be hungry in full condition and ready to hunt. So in that condition, the birds would naturally come in and try to take the seagulls or the gulls. In this state, they may give chase. Their presence being known is very dangerous to the gulls. And they may, chase after them, but they're not willing to commit to catching them and risk getting hurt while tackling them. It's not time to eat yet.
You have such a line of work that very few people know anything about. I understand you've been doing training birds of prey for three decades. You started with police dogs. You've worked for zoos. You've worked with exotic animals. People like you are not many. And I'm wondering if you're doing this solo or if you got a team of people doing it.
No, there's quite a few people. Well, I shouldn't say quite a few, maybe 100 people across the United States that I know of that do bird abatement like this. It's It's something that's gained traction over the years. When I first started, it was actually you couldn't use what we call non-MBTA or native species to the United States. We had to use non-MBTA species. So things like lanners, sakers, falcons that come from other countries. Now, with the bird abatement, we're allowed to get a permit from the federal government, and we're allowed to use species like peregrines and gyrfalcons and Harris hawks and, species that are from the United States, although they have to be captive bred. So we're not allowed to take any wild species and use them, but we are allowed to have captive bred birds and use them for this work.
Last thing, and we only have 30 seconds, I understand that you do some kind of conditioning of the seagulls where you get them used to the idea that there's a falcon there, but there's also some kind of explosive device connected with it. Real quick, how does that work?
That's usually used on like a garbage dump type of situation, and it's just what you're doing is conditioning the bird. So every time it sees the falcon, it hears this noise, and it works on all birds. And then when you set that explosive device off or screamer off, the birds automatically think falcon in the air, run.
Eric Swanson is a master falconer with East Coast Falcons. So this hour, we're talking about animals behaving badly, or at least badly from our perspective as humans. We're going to wrap up the hour now with a look at one of the most pervasive problems in any American park, and that would be poop. Canada goose poop, to be precise. To get the lowdown, Marcus Smith spoke with Blair Stringham, the Migratory Game Bird Coordinator for Utah's Division of Wildlife Resources. Here's a cut from that conversation.
A lot of cities have tried to take action, you know, and take the geese out of those areas or provide ways of reducing the conflicts, and it's really a love-hate relationship. People have found that as we come to try to take the geese, your initial thought would be, oh, that'll be great because we're removing the problem, but there's on the opposite side of that coin, there's people that absolutely love seeing those birds. They're out there feeding them all the time or just watching them swim in the ponds, and they love them just as much as the other people hate them. And so it creates a real conflict within communities to try to address this issue because there's essentially polar conflicts occurring, and it's hard to find a middle ground that'll make everybody happy.
We will talk about these proposed and some of them implemented solutions. But before, I have to go back to this extinction business. The cause for them becoming endangered decades ago, just overhunting?
So part of it was hunting, and then part of it was just the loss of habitat. A lot of the wetlands all across North America have been lost, largely due to development. And so because of that, you know, they lost where they were living, essentially. And so just like people, if you lose your home and have nowhere to go and have no food or water, you know, people would do the same thing. And so there was a time where we were really worried we were going to lose the Canada goose, which is probably hard to believe now because they're so frequently seen anywhere, whether you're out in the middle of a wet pond in the middle of nowhere in Canada or you're in downtown New York, you're likely going to be able to find a Canada goose within a couple hundred yards of you.
And that resurgence of the population, that has happened after those protections were put in place. Is it time to revisit what the law says about taking out geese?
Yeah, and so it's complicated because they are a federally protected bird, and so that gives them protection under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which is essentially an agreement between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. And so they're heavily regulated because of that document, because we want to make sure they never get back to the point of where they're extinct. But there is a lot of growing concerns of how are we going to address this problem. And so we have to refer back to that document, but we've been able to find ways to expand hunting seasons that still fit within that framework of the document, but you know can be a little more aggressive as far as hunting's concerned. The federal government has also allowed us to do things like destroy nests and eggs and things like that just to keep the population in check, particularly in areas where we really don't want any more Canada geese. The population continues to grow, but as it grows in unwanted areas, it becomes a huge problem, and it's a challenge to try to work within that treaty, but at the same time, solve problems.
I want to do a hypothetical with you. Suppose we were not to try to lessen the numbers. Suppose we were going to just say we're going to live with them. What would happen?
Really nothing. I think it'd be just a change of perspective and values by humans. You know, like I was saying earlier, there's still people out there that love to see the Canada geese in their backyards. And I think it's more of them just being more tolerant of the problems the geese are causing. They're not as concerned about them eating their tulips or as concerned about having to step in a goose present now and again. But then there's people that just are absolutely intolerant of them. They want them gone. And so, you know, to do nothing is really going to have to increase people's level of tolerance. And for some people, that'll work. And some people, it's unacceptable.
So it's a social problem amongst us humans, if you characterize it that way.
Yeah, and that's probably where the largest problem comes. But, I mean, there are other issues that we do have to consider. I mean, oftentimes having that number of birds in an area can cause disease issues. And so there are some implications that, you know, if left unchecked, I mean, we're likely to deal with some even bigger consequences of just tolerating them.
Well, what kind of disease issues? They're not mosquitoes carrying malaria.
No. So a lot of their fecal matter can cause disease issues. A lot of just damage to the environment of the ecosystem. And so if you have too many animals in one concentration, they can spread disease not only to the humans around them, but also to themselves, and it could essentially annihilate the population in that area.
Yeah. Now, why would we single out Canada geese in particular? I have seen pictures of these huge, huge flocks of, I think they're called snow geese, and they seem to get a pass on this.
Yeah, and largely because of the way that those birds live. I mean, the snow geese, for example, they are in huge flocks of tens of thousands. They tend to primarily focus on agricultural areas or just natural wetlands. Whereas the Canada goose, for some reason, it's just really been able to focus in on places where lots of people are at, like a golf course or a park. And so because of that, we have to deal with a lot more of their problems. There are some agricultural problems with things like snow geese and other animals like that, but generally those animals that are, you know, downtown Chicago or places like that are really the ones that get a lot of publicity and get a lot of interest from wildlife managers and the public to try to solve those issues.
Now, radio is always very exciting when you can get the guests to scold us all, and I'm wondering if you can talk about, if you were to scold us about what not to do. I know hand feeding of geese, that's a problem. That's a no-no, right?
Yeah, so we've tried to discourage that for a long time, to feed any kind of waterfowl. And unfortunately, it's one of those popular activities that people like to go and just throw bread out for ducks and geese. And it's really not very good on their digestive system. And it also makes it so they're not getting all the nutrients that they need to adequately survive and to migrate and things like that. And so that's probably the biggest thing that people can do, is just not feeding animals, both because of the problems it causes with that specific animal, but it's also a way of attracting animals and making it so they won't migrate, or so they're concentrating in an area. And so some of those disease issues or damage start to come into play. And without the birds migrating, sometimes they have to do that because it's harder for birds to spend the winter in an area where everything freezes up, there's no water available or things like that, and that can cause huge problems with survival for a lot of these birds if they're not doing what they naturally should be.
Now, given your expertise, I would imagine that you have seen a goose nest or two.
Yeah, yes, I have. I've seen a few.
Are you hands-on in doing stuff with the eggs? Do you smash them? What do you do?
So we don't directly do that. We encourage landowners to do that, though. So people that own properties, golf courses, it's really popular with. It's a permit that they get from the Fish and Wildlife Service, which they can go out and they can destroy the nest. Some people will just simply shake the eggs and leave them there. So they're essentially unviable. They're not going to hatch. Essentially, it's just a way to keep the population from reproducing. It's also a way just to deter geese from being aggressive. So during that nesting season, they'll chase people and things like that. And so by destroying a nest, oftentimes those geese will leave the area and go somewhere else and try to nest or stop nesting at all. And so really it's a population management as well as that nuisance.
Is breaking the eggs, you say shaking the eggs is what you do, you shake them?
Yep, so you can shake them, but you can also pour an oil on them, and essentially just makes it so they won't continue to develop. And that's kind of the goal of trying to reduce urban geese, is to essentially stop them from reproducing and leave the area. And so the nest approach is really a successful tool for a lot of people that have continual problems with geese. An average goose will lay about 5 eggs per year, and so if it can successfully reduce one time, it's essentially replaced itself five times. And so you can imagine over the course of a little goose lifespan of 5 to 10 years, it could produce a lot of geese from two all the way up to hundreds relatively quickly.
Yeah. Now, because of the nature of your job, because you're managing wildlife, I have to say I have great admiration for someone who can talk to the public, because you're going to get it from both sides. You're going to get it from people who say, let's have more hunting permits. Let's not be tampering with the nests. Let's keep them. Let's get rid of them. Is there any way to educate the public that you've learned in your job that's really going to resonate with people to help address this properly?
Yeah, and really just trying to not provide the resources that they need. And so a lot of, the first thing an apartment complex will do is it'll put in nice green grass, it'll put in a fountain, and then those things are going to immediately attract geese. And so as your, areas are developing their landscape, they need to be cognizant of that and trying to provide the things that geese want. The other thing is that once a goose comes onto your property, a lot of times we encourage people to scare those away, because the more comfortable they feel on your property, the more likely they are to stay. And so people that are proactive and are constantly trying to shoo geese away generally have fewer problems than those that, initially really love having the geese there and then all of a sudden realize, oh, no, this is a problem that I probably shouldn't have brought on.
Blair Stringham is the Migratory Game Bird Coordinator for Utah's Division of Wildlife Resources. He was speaking there with Marcus Smith. I'm Tenery Taylor. When COVID hit in 2020 and people were confined to their homes, a quiet settled on some of our wild places, and then something unusual happened. We'll visit a national forest where ponies ran wild during lockdown, surprising even one veteran wildlife photographer.
You'd sort of come around the corner and there'd be a herd of 30 ponies barreling down the road towards you.
Lessons learned in a forest during lockdown. Tomorrow on Constant Wonder.